Okay, so requests. talk about God, talk about, what was the other one? Well, this one is how to meditate. And there was something from yesterday. Okay, let's start about talking about God. I'm not sure if everybody wants to hear about God, but I was asked to talk about God, and all I can give you is my own story. It's not going to be everyone's story. And I'm just wondering, is anybody sitting in here with a copy of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind with them? How close? Okay. Because there's a really nice chapter in it called God-giving. So now if I start telling you about my God story, Jill will miss it. So we'll wait for Jill to come back. One great benefit I found from Zen practice was the ability to wait. So you find yourself in a line at the supermarket that just isn't moving, or is moving very slow, or you're in a doctor's office or dentist chair. Just to wait, just to experience the situation as it is. It's a great gift. Thank you. Or at an airport, or any place where you find yourself having to wait. And it's what somebody described as a practice that is very portable. You can take it anywhere with you. You don't even have to sit to do it. You can just stand and be present. 61. Here we go. So is this too long to read? No. But the page after it is really fabulous. Possibly the best page in the book. It's just the drawing of a household fly. However, before that, we've got God-giving, and I'll read it. This is, he starts off with what I was saying yesterday. To give is non-attachment. That is, just not to attach to anything is to give. And that's in quotation marks. And the first part, to give is non-attachment, is in its own quotation marks within the quote. Okay. Every existence in nature, every existence in the human world, every cultural work that we create is something which was given. or is being given to us, relatively speaking. But as everything is originally one, we are, in actuality, giving out everything. Moment after moment, we are creating something, and this is the joy of our life. But this I, which is creating and always giving out something, is not the small I, it is the big I. Even though you do not realize the oneness of this big I with everything, when you give something, you feel good. Because at that time you feel at one with what you are giving. This is why it feels better to give than to take. We have a saying, Dana Prajna Paramita, or Dana Prajna Paramita. Dana means to give, prajna is wisdom, and paramita means to cross over, also means perfection, or to reach the other shore. Our life can be seen as a crossing of a river. The goal of our life's effort is to reach the other shore, nirvana. Prajna paramita, the true wisdom of life, is that in each step of the way, the other shore is actually reached. To reach the other shore with each step of the crossing is the way of true living. Dana Prajna Paramita is the first of the six ways of true living. The second is Sila Prajna Paramita, or the Buddhist precepts. Then there are Shanti Prajna Paramita, or endurance, Virya Prajna Paramita, or ardor and constant effort, Jnana Prajna Paramita, or Zen practice, and Prajna Paramita, or wisdom. Actually, these six Prajna Paramita are one. But as we can observe life from various sides, we count six. Dogen Zenji said, to give is non-attachment. That is, just not to attach to anything is to give. It does not matter what is given. To give a penny or to give a leaf is Dana Prajna Paramita. To give one line or even one word of teaching is Dana Prajna Paramita. If given in the spirit of non-attachment, the material offering and the teaching offering have the same value. With the right spirit, all that we do, all that we create, is Dana Prajna Paramita. So Dogen said, to produce something, to participate in human activity, is also Dana Prajna Paramita. To provide a ferry boat for people or to make a bridge for people is Dana Prajna Paramita. Actually, to give one line of the teaching may be to make a ferry boat for someone. This is why I want to read this. According to Christianity, every existence in nature is something which was created for or given to us by God. That is the perfect idea of giving. But if you think that God created humans and that you are somehow separate from God, you are liable to think you have the ability to create something separate, something not given by Him. For instance, we create airplanes, and highways. And when we repeat, I create, I create, I create, soon we forget who is actually the I which creates the various things. We soon forget about God. This is the danger of human culture. Actually, to create with the big I is to give. We cannot create and own what we create for ourselves, since everything was created by God. This point should not be forgotten. But because we do forget who is doing the creating and the reason for the creation, we become attached to the material or exchange value. This has no value in comparison to the absolute value of something as God's creation. Even though something has no material or relative value to any small I, it has absolute value in itself. Not to be attached to something is to be aware of its absolute value. Everything you do should be based on such awareness and not on material or self-centered ideas of value. Then whatever you do is true giving. It is dana prajna paramita. When we sit in the cross-legged posture, we resume our fundamental activity of creation. There are perhaps, and that reminds me what the other thing was, can Zazen help in making decisions? Okay. There are perhaps three kinds of creation. The first is to be aware of ourselves after we finish Zazen. When we sit, we are nothing. We do not even realize what we are. We just sit. But when we stand up, we are there. That is the first step in creation. When you are there, everything else is there. Everything is created all at once. When we emerge from nothing, when everything emerges from nothing, we see it all as a fresh new creation. This is non-attachment. The second kind of creation is when you act or produce or prepare something like food or tea. The third kind is to create something within yourself, such as education or culture or art or some system for our society. So there are three kinds of creation. But if you forget the first, the most important one, the other two will be like children who have lost their parents. Their creation will mean nothing. Usually, everyone forgets about Zazen. Everyone forgets about God. They work very hard at the second and third kinds of creation, but God does not help the activity. How is it possible for him to help when he does not realize who he is? That is why we have so many problems in this world, when we forget the fundamental source of our creating. We are like children who do not know what to do when they lose their parents. If you understand dana prajna paramita, you will understand how it is we create so many problems for ourselves. Of course, to live is to create problems. If we did not appear in this world, our parents would have no difficulty with us. Just by appearing, we create problems for them. This is all right. Everything creates some problems. But usually people think that when they die, everything is over. The problems disappear. But your death may create problems too. Actually, our problems should be solved or dissolved. Oh, that's not the end of it. Okay. Solved or dissolved in life, in this life. But if we are aware that what we do or what we create is really the gift of the big I, then we will not be attached to it and we will not create problems for ourselves or for others. And we should forget, day by day, what we have done. This is true non-attachment. And we should do something new. To do something new, of course, we must know our past, and this is all right. But we should not keep holding on to anything we have done. We should only reflect on it. And we must have some idea of what we should do in the future. But the future is the future. The past is the past. Now we should work on something new. This is our attitude. And how we should live in this world. This is Dana Prajna Paramita. To give something or to create something for ourselves. So to do something through and through is to resume our true activity of creation. This is why we sit. If we do not forget this point, everything will be carried on beautifully. But once we forget this point, the world will be filled with confusion. So when I read this, I think the first time, so many years ago, 30 years ago or so, I did not believe in God. And when I read this, I did not feel as though I was being asked to believe in God. I felt as though he was just using God because that was a cultural norm, and I was fairly impressed with how he could use the cultural language to make a point or to get something across. I didn't feel as though he necessarily believed in God, and I certainly didn't get the impression that Buddhism was a God-oriented religion. So, to me, the essential point in all that is we think that we create something, or we think that we make something, and we forget that the something we've made, the materials that we've used, come from the same source as ourselves have come from. In other words, we have come up or arisen in dependence upon causes and conditions, and the materials that we have, we may create something, but we couldn't do it without those causes and conditions, without those materials. We are as empty as it is. Okay. So I'd like that Suzuki Roshi was able to talk in terms of God, even though Zen is not really a God-oriented religion, or any kind of, is it a religion? Well, maybe. Right. So my own story about God. I grew up in Catholic Ireland, and I have to say I grew up as a believer, and you know, I was in a family who believed, so I believed, right? And was, I think, in my early 20s that I got my first koan. Now, I'm not too sure what the conditions were that brought about this koan. Something to do with reading Plato, Plato's Republic, and I realized that a lot of Catholic teaching came from Plato, but they didn't seem to acknowledge it. Okay. And something to do from the contradictions that I saw in the work environment that I was in, where people seemed to be both like devout Christians and horribly corrupt. Right? And this combination of things, so coming out of school, coming out of this Catholic family, and then going into the workplace, but keeping my interest, my intellectual interest going, maybe they were just peripheral conditions. and something deeper was going on. But I remember asking myself, could I be happy if it was scientifically proven that there is no life after death? And I call this my first koan. Maybe there were other koans, but this is one I'm conscious of. And I seem to think that it took a week to solve. So it wasn't a very big koan. I mean, big koans take years. Right? You could see Siddhartha's koan as, what is the end of dukkha? Right? And he goes off on a 6-year expedition and reaches the answer to the koan. He discovers the end of dukkha. So in this one, I thought, could I be happy if it was scientifically proven? And I wasn't saying that it could be scientifically proven, but if, that there is no life after death. And I call this my first koan because I remember as the days went by, it occupied more and more of my consciousness so that it seemed to be the only thing I was dwelling on or thinking of, whether it was eating, the classic thing, whether you're standing, sitting, walking, or lying down, I was just like turning it over. Could I possibly be happy? You know, wow, okay. And I remember going to sleep one night, and as I drifted, I started to smile, because the answer came. Yes, I could. Okay. And then I woke up the next morning, and it was like the floodgates opened. All these questions. Why do you believe that there is a life after death? And all I could come up with is, other people have told me so. Why do you believe that there is a God? And all I could come up with is, other people have told me so. I mean, whatever answer I came up with, it came back to the same thing as, other people have told me so. So I converted myself to being an atheist. And I was quite happy with being an atheist. But at some point along the lines, I felt as though something was missing. Life was getting to be very dry, and I got into existentialism, where the question is, if there is no God, then the universe has no intrinsic meaning or value. So how do we live a life that has value? How do we live a meaningful life? That was a great existentialist conundrum. What can we possibly do that has value and meaning? And then I came across Buddhism. Well, actually, I thought, you know, I used to meditate when I was a teenager. I did some yoga and some meditation, and then I also did some transcendental meditation. Who didn't? Okay, TM. I did that, and I thought, you know, maybe what's missing is to be found in meditation, that my life was getting to be too technical and dry, and it needed some lubricant or something to, I don't know. So I started to do some of these teenage yoga breathing exercises as meditation, and then doors started opening up. So if you look, if you seek, you will find. And I picked up Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Okay, I thought, wow, this is great. It doesn't give a whole lot of instruction, but it does communicate a certain flavor. I remember reading it and thinking, ooh, there's another way to go about life. Like that was the transformation of reading Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that my whole approach to life might be wrong or might be part of the problem. there's another way to go about life, and I knew that because there's another way to view life. And I knew that there was another way to view life because that's what Suzuki Roshi is communicating, this other way to deal with life, to view life, to be, this other way to be. So I was very excited and inspired by this little book. And then after that I saw an advertisement in a magazine saying free public talk by an ordained Buddhist teacher. And this had something to do with Buddhism and Zen, so okay, I'll go to the free public talk by the ordained Buddhist teacher. And the free public talk was in the Well-Fed Cafe, which was a cafe that I frequented. It was a co-op cafe, cooperative cafe. So I went along and the talk was kind of okay. He seemed like a nice guy. And he said he would be giving a 6-week meditation course, one evening a week for 6 weeks, starting in April or something. And if you might be interested, give him your name and address. So I did, put on a piece of paper, got the flyer, went to the course, and thought, this is great. Right. And then after doing the meditation course, there's a little bit of a second course, and in the second course, there's a bit of Buddhist teachings. So I'm approaching the Buddhist teachings with a certain amount of caution because I'd already given up one religion and I didn't really want to get into another one. But as I looked at the teachings, they held up, they made sense, they stood up to whatever scrutiny I could give them. So where does God come into all of this? Because I didn't have to bring God back into the equation. Eventually I went to Green Gulch and I started, I did a first practice period, and I think it was towards the end of the first practice period, possibly because of talks that were given, I began to see that, in Buddhism you've got the relative and the absolute, and in a certain way you can talk about the absolute using the word God, or you can kind of equate God with the absolute. And so I began to fantasize that I could actually go back to Ireland and practice as a Catholic, and I could see myself doing all those practices that I used to do when I was growing up, and they would all be mindfulness exercises. And my consciousness would be orienting itself towards the absolute, but calling it God. Okay, so that could work, you know. So relive my early life, orienting myself towards God, and doing all these mindfulness practices. If I reinterpret all that, it actually makes a lot of sense, you know. And as I played out the various scenarios that might arise, I imagined like some of the conversations that could happen, and some that would be based on experience, like some of the conversations that I had, we'll say, as a teenager, and how people would talk about God. And they'd say things like, God willing, absolute willing, doesn't quite fit. It'll work out if God wills it. Does the absolute take this personal kind of, or praying to God for certain things? Can you pray to the absolute? And then I thought, it's not going to quite work. We'd be using the same word, but we would have different meanings associated with it. So the kind of fantasies collapsed. I didn't really believe that I could make it work. And I still don't. My own experience of growing up in Catholic Ireland is that God is pretty much fixed. Maybe it's loosening up a little bit, but there's so much baggage associated with God, that if you take on God, you also take on this baggage. I really don't want to go down that route. But I know that there's a lot of Buddhist teachers who are quite comfortable with it, quite comfortable talking about the absolute and using the term God, or talking about God as if they know what they're talking about. But they haven't grown up in Catholic Ireland. They've grown up in America, which is really open in many ways. At least parts of it, they didn't grow up in Bible Belt America. So I don't dismiss other people's spirituality, but going along this, taking God on board with me doesn't really work for me. But I do like Suzuki Roshi being able to talk in terms of God. And God-giving. It's really great. I remember that back in, I think it was 2000 or so, when the Dalai Lama was giving a 2001. No, it could have been 2000. Dalai Lama was giving a conference in Belfast, and Norman, who was my teacher, wanted to go there and suggested that I go along with him, not to the conference, but on the trip. So we both flew in an airplane, and it was really nice traveling with my teacher. And we did one or two events in Dublin, and then he went up to the conference and he came back down. And we went over to London and Cockfosters. There's a priest there, well, he was there 20 years ago, Father Lawrence. And Norman was very much into the interfaith dialogue. So between Zen and Judaism, between Zen and Christianity, or Buddhism and Christianity. And if you're interested in Christian spirituality, there's a really good book, which I have not read, called Benedict's Dharma. Yeah? And it's the parallels between Buddhist practice and Saint Benedict's practice. Okay. And this came out of a conference that Norman and other teachers were at around about that time, or just before it, at a Christian monastery, I think it's called Gethsemane, somewhere in America, near California, near the border with Arizona, somewhere. Anyway, from this conference, interfaith conference, there came out this book. There's Norman Fisher is one of the writers. I don't know if somebody Goldberg is one of them. Do you know? Oh, you don't remember? Okay. So anyway, apparently it's a great book. And so we were going, from this, he somehow struck up a conversation with Father Lawrence. And at the time, Father Lawrence was head of the World Community of Christian Meditators. And part of what was happening was they had this dual act. So you had Norman, the Zen master, and Lawrence, the Christian meditator, and people were invited in to listen to them and then to ask questions. And Norman told stories about the Zen koans, and Lawrence told stories about the Desert Fathers, which actually do have a kind of koan-like, some of them do have a koan-like quality to them. But I remember at the end, somebody asked the question, is it possible to be Christian and Buddhist at the same time? And Norman was, yeah, sure. It doesn't see any problem with it. And from a Zen perspective, there isn't really a problem with it. But with other Buddhist schools, there may be, because the Theravadins, there was this great book out called A Buddhist Critique of the Christian Concept of God. I'm kind of sorry I didn't read it, but I felt as though I had done enough of my own critique to be comfortable with where I was, and I didn't need the support of somebody else. So Zen really doesn't have a problem with you practicing other faiths or other religions, but some Buddhist schools do, because they see a belief in a personal or theistic God as something that will actually get in the way of your spiritual progress. If you think that the ultimate responsibility is with somebody else and not with you, that's not going to do you a lot of good. The same could be said, of, we'll say, forms of Buddhism where you give that responsibility to your teacher. Right? Zen is not one of those schools. So Norman's answer was yes, no problem. But Lawrence had a problem with it. He said, sooner or later, you're going to have to decide if Jesus is your Lord and Savior. Right? So, having said that, there are Christian priests who have received Dharma transmission. Now, that says more, perhaps, about Zen than about God, but I often wonder, what does that do to their belief in God and in the Christianity that they are teaching? So one of these modern Christian Zen priests will be Father Robert Kennedy, who's still alive and teaching. And I had a student in Belfast who was going to one of Roshi Kennedy's, Kennedy Roshi, one of his sesshins. And he came back saying, oh, it's just pure Zen. There was no Christianity in it. But at the end of it, he was asked a question by a nun, and I imagine it was a Christian nun who came on the sesshin, who said, you've written a book, Zen Gifts for Christians, right? What about Christianity's gifts to Zen? And he said, there are none. So I guess he had his Zen hat on when he was doing that and not his Christian hat on. This is it. Can you ever change hats? I don't know. So I'm happy if people, or I'm comfortable if people want to practice Zen and they want to practice Christianity, or if they want to explore Christianity. And there is a lot of value in exploring Christian mystics, because they can really change how you view the world. A little bit like reading Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, they can help dissolve that kind of fixed view that we have of the world. I do remember coming across some quotes from Meister Eckhart. And one of them is, everything exists under the shadow of emptiness. I thought, wow, that's pretty good. That's kind of Zen-like. Yeah. And another one was, this is really brilliant, the eye with which I see God is the same as the eye with which God sees me. Pretty good. So with that kind of take on God, yeah, I could probably go along with it, but there's all this other baggage that I don't want to take on. A year or two ago, a friend sent me a link to a video. I guess it was on YouTube, but maybe not. And the title of it was something like An Atheist God, The God of Spinoza. Okay, I'll listen to this. And it's fascinating. So Spinoza, I think maybe a medieval or later than medieval philosopher, whatever. For him, nature is God. So it's not as though nature takes the place of God. Nature, or the natural world, is God. So I could kind of go along with that. It's very much like the phenomenal universe is the nirmanakaya, or the physical body of the Buddha. I'm saying that nature is God. But most people who believe in God don't really see it that way, but if you do see it that way, yeah. If that's the case, do we need the word God? Can we just say nature? So for Spinoza, nature is God, or was God, is God. And that changes things differently, because in Christianity, God created nature. And as Suzuki Roshi says, then God is separate from nature, or we conceive God as being separate from nature. Whereas if nature is God, then it's like there is no separation between them. But then we have to ask the question, like, does nature have a will? Does nature have a personal interest in our fate? I think it's Kierkegaard said something, and I saw this in a church door as I was going out. The object of prayer is not to get something from God, but to change the heart of the person praying. Oh, that's really good. So yeah, there are many ways of exploring God and exploring concepts of it that may in fact be nourishing. I just don't feel the need to go down there. So that's my take on God. There is one other thing, I suppose. I was saying that there are some priests, Christian priests, who have received Dharma transmission, and they tend to be Jesuits. And I think the first, or one of the first significant ones, was Father De La Salle. And so in Switzerland, you have the De La Salle house, and I saw a picture of it. And it's a long room, wooden floor, not carpeted, which is very nice. I like the aesthetic of the wood. And you've got the black zabutons and zafus all lined up. And then on the wall you've got a crucifix. I thought, oh gosh. Sitting zazen with this crucifix doesn't quite do it. Contrast that with 20 years ago or so, I was home in Dublin just visiting, and a friend of mine says, have you seen the Buddha bar? I said, no. He says, I have to take you to it. So Sunday morning, we go to the Buddha bar for coffee. You walk in, place was empty. But, I don't know, twice your height is where the ceiling starts for the Buddha. It's a glass ceiling. And perched on it, or sitting on it, is an equally tall statue of the Buddha. I can only imagine, I was talking with my brother-in-law about it afterwards, he said it must be made of paper mache or something. The size of it, it could not really have a substantial structure. So it was probably a prop for a movie or something like that, and they got it. But the structure of the building has like a dome that the head actually needs to fit into. So you go in there. And it's also a disco bar. They weren't doing the disco thing. At the dance floor behind the bar. And I could just imagine, you know, like you have a few pints And you look up and you see this larger than life, this huge statue of the Buddha. Total peaceful serenity. And maybe a fight breaks out because people are drinking or trying to get off with this person or that person. People are dancing. Samsara meets nirvana. It works. I thought it was great. You know, what all the various scenarios that this serene Buddha figure saw. And all the people in those scenarios who saw this serene Buddha figure, maybe you go home and you're dreaming. And it somehow works its way into your dreams and you realize that I must do something about this. I must go and learn to meditate. I want to be like that statue. Right? Whereas sitting zazen while somebody is being crucified, no, it didn't work. But people work with it. People practice with it. And I don't want to detract from whatever it is or wherever it is that you find nourishment. It's just that I'm not about to bring God into this room. No more than that. How are we for time? Good. I can certainly talk a lot. It's 10 to 5, so... making decisions. Can zazen help make decisions? That was a question. And I hope it's not one of the people who left who asked it. That brings me into another topic. Zazen can help you not to make a decision. And by not making a decision, you may end up making a better decision. So let me explain that one. There's something in us, we feel compelled to know. We feel compelled to know what the nature of reality is. We feel compelled to know what the answer to this question is. We feel compelled to know what's going to happen when we leave here. We feel compelled to know what it was that actually happened before we got here. We are beings that know things. We are knowing. We know things. And so quite often we know that a situation is coming up and we're going to have to make a decision. And that situation may be 2 months down the road. But because we know it's coming up, we feel as though we want the answer now. So we feel compelled to know. And zazen can be very good at being comfortable with not knowing. And it's in that not knowing that the space is held open, and so things can change. And so as we get closer to the deadline, so to speak, other information may have become available. The situation may have totally changed, and so our decision is more informed. The other thing that can happen is if we decide that we must know in advance, we make up our mind way ahead of time. And then as new information arrives, we dismiss it because we already know the answer. So zazen is really good at holding things open. And it's that openness. There is a really great saying. Not knowing is most intimate. Now, just to unpack that a little bit, I can see another half hour coming up. Okay. Not knowing is most intimate. The story goes, Bodhidharma had to visit the emperor because you don't teach on the emperor's patch without checking in with the emperor first and letting him know what it is that you're doing. So Bodhidharma, well, that wasn't the real situation. The emperor was a supporter of Buddhist practice and he was a donor to Buddhist temples and he wanted to encourage Buddhism. So he thought, there's a new Buddhist teacher in town, Bodhidharma, bring him here for an interview. So Bodhidharma goes to Emperor Wu and they have a conversation. And the emperor asks Bodhidharma, what is the highest teaching of the Noble Truths? Now, the answer usually given in English is, I don't know. My feeling is that the characters are probably knowing and a negation for knowing, so not knowing. So the answer is probably more like not knowing. But I could be wrong. The highest teaching of the Noble Truths, I'm suggesting, is not knowing. Because when you don't know something, so this is a question. Not knowing, it's not with the activity of knowing. So it's not knowing, not trying to know. In that not knowing, you are not separating. It's in the knowing that you are separating. You are separating what you know from everything else. So the highest teaching of the Noble Truths is not knowing, because in that not knowing, there is no separating or no separation. It's in not knowing is most intimate. As you sit in Zazen, you become intimate with the now, the here and now, or just the now. Part of the now is what's going on in your own body, the sensations that are going on, and some of those sensations may be pain. Usually we try to resist pain and push it away, separate it from us. It's not part of me, I don't want it. But there is a way of sitting which we find ourselves in from time to time, and we find that we're able to allow the pain to be there. We're able to include it as part of our experience. So this is becoming intimate with the pain. We're allowing it to be there. The same can be true for feelings and emotions or mental states in general. And with the sounds around us. It's when we stop grasping at things or pushing them away that we actually become intimate with them. And this intimacy reaches a culmination where we're just experiencing it directly without knowing it. Knowing it is bringing it into consciousness or a narrative. We're not experiencing it directly. We're experiencing it as something mediated through consciousness or through narrative, through language. So it's the absence of that which is a direct experience, and we have become part of it and it has become part of us. So does Zazen help make decisions? So it helps us not to make decisions. Mm. And that not making decisions can lead to better decisions. It can certainly lead to decisions that are more connected. They're based more on a deeper connection to the situation than the kind of decision making we would have made earlier, where we just have to know what the answer is. And once we know the answer, we're not going to be flexible. That's a kind of a rigidity that Zen practice tends to undermine. Okay, and then I hope that answers the person's question. Does it help make decisions? It can also help make decisions in the sense that our minds become clearer through zazen, by doing a retreat. If you have an important decision to make, I would highly recommend that you do a sesshin beforehand, and that after, through the sesshin, you don't know the answer. And even if you can not think about it, and then in the clarity of mind that follows, and the clarity of heart that follows, then you make your decision. So if you have an important decision to make, and you've got a good zazen practice, you might instinctively know that what you need to do before deciding is one or two periods of zazen or a day of zazen. And what are you actually doing? This was another question. What are we doing in zazen? What do you focus on? We don't focus on anything in particular. Now, you may find it helpful to focus on your breath for a while. That's something that's happening in the present, and you might as well focus on it. But there are other forms of meditation practice where you focus on the breath and you try to bring more and more consciousness on the breath so that the breath is actually an object of concentration. In zazen, it wouldn't really be an object of concentration. It would just be something that helps us to be present. Bringing our attention to our body and to our posture, although we're not focused on it, but bringing our attention to it, that will help us to stay present. And one little detail on that, I like to see if my posture at the end of zazen can actually be a little bit better than it was at the beginning. Usually it's the other way around. Our posture deteriorates as we go through. But can the direction of our posture be towards improvement? And I often find it like halfway through, there's just something that opens up and I go, oh, there's another little bit. Huh. Great. So the direction of our posture is towards improvement rather than towards deterioration. But of course our bodies get tired, and if we sit for long periods of time, eventually our posture will begin to deteriorate. But can we actually, like, just little bit by little bit, millimeter by millimeter, work our way into a better posture? So without focusing exclusively on any sense experience, we let our mind be open to all our sense experiences. So I hear the birds. When you hear the bird, your mind might say, that's a bird. You might even recognize it, that's a blackbird. Okay. You may find that you hear the notes, and then your mind repeats them. Okay, as you get very still and very quiet, or you hear a door opening, and your mind repeats it. By the time you know that you've heard it, it's in the past. And you become aware of this, that the echo or the repetition that takes place in your mind is of something that is in the past. So you ask yourself, can I be just present? So you're getting closer and closer and closer and closer and closer to a direct experience. The door opens and closes. You hear it, but there is no repetition. When the door is closed, the story is over. And you're just there for the next thing. So being present for what is arising rather than what has arisen. So we may notice that, oh, there's a tingling sensation in my arm. As somebody who came to see me, can you be there when it stops? And that's very true. I was saying, yes, that's a really good practice. Not just be there for when it rises, but for when it stops. And I find particularly with sounds or images, there's this repetition of it. You see it again, you hear it again, but what you're hearing is like a replay. Or there's a recognition of what you have heard, and notice what you have heard. Can we get to the point where we hear it, and when it stops, that's the end of it? Because something else is arising. So that's what we're aiming for, just to be totally present. At least that's what I say we're aiming for. Other Zen teachers might say something else. If that resonates with you, great. And if it doesn't resonate with you, find something that does. So what do we focus on? You can focus on your posture, you can focus on your breathing as a way in to being present, so as a kind of an anchor. You can also have a phrase, like for a long time that poem that I recited that evening in April, I would just repeat it a few times to myself, and that would help to center me and help me to be present, and then I would explore variations of it. So the birds sang in the wet trees. Okay. And as I listened to them, it was 100 years from now. So then I think, well, I could be sitting here. What about 100 years from now? Somebody else would be sitting here. Is that person related or connected to me in any way? No. Just to explore it like dropping pennies in, repeating the phrase or the lines can help to center you. You may have a koan. What is my face before I was born? How could I have a face before I was born? What is it? And while we're on this topic, your koan could be, what is God? Or who is God? So in Zen we have the koan, who am I? If you want to bring God into your practice, you could say, what is God? What is God? And by repeating that to yourself as you sit, it will help keep you centered, and it will also help keep your mind here. Every time it goes off on some kind of tangent or story, you just ask, yeah, but the real question is, what is God? Not, what are we having for dinner? Right? That brings you back to being here. Right? So you repeat the koan or the question again and again and again. And in doing that, you're not cutting off your ears or your nose or your eyes. You're still attentive or aware of the sensations around you and in your environment. Okay, I think that's way more than enough for today. Thank you all very much for your patience.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.